Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Are you telling me you never planted any evidence, Sergeant?
Planting evidence. Framing suspect.
That's a lie.
I think I can prove it, Sergeant.
What do I do?
Keep after him. Brace him. Brace him.
He's going to leave this town wishing he and that wife of his had never been born.
Welcome to The Syndicate, a film and TV podcast. Be a part of the conversation as industry insiders, genre lovers, and cinephiles dare to peek beyond the curtains of imagination and dive into the art of cinema. Join us as we want you to spend less time scrolling and more time watching. Now here's your host, Armand Haddad.
Guys, thank you again for coming on. Last time we talked was Shin Ultraman, so we did Mulholland Drive. Fun. Shin Ultraman, mm-hmm. And now we're talking about The Touch of Evil.
What's our theme?
I was just about to ask
going all over the place. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Mike, thank you again for coming back. Diego, thank you for coming back.
Thank you.
Glad to have you two on again. So, let's get the ball rolling. Even though I suggested this, mm-hmm. because, like, Mike, you were like, let's watch an Orson Welles film. And I didn't want to be a normie and say, let's watch Citizen Kane. So, I was like, okay. Let's watch The Touch of Evil. Now, you've seen this before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought you had already seen it, and I was like, oh, why did Armand pick that? Like, right. Well, I'm like wondering, like, if you like a certain style or, like, themes or whatever, and then I'm like, oh, partway through, I think we were, like, 10 minutes in, you were like, yeah, I've never seen this. And I was like, oh, well, now, like, because mm-hmm. you silently yeah. feel the audience you're with, you know, like, who hasn't seen it. You're, like, keeping your eye on it. Uh-huh. And I was keeping an eye on you, like, how is he watching it this time? And it's like, oh, you're just watching it for the first time. Mm-hmm. And you and Diego, you hadn't seen it yet.
No,
and,
not yet. You've shown me the opening scene, though. You've just, mm-hmm. you were, because I think I talked about something about, what is that one movie where it's, it has a really long, it's shot very long. It's in World War One.
Oh,
1917.
1917? Yeah, yeah. Or was it an earlier one?
No, I think it was that one. But I think we were talking about that. And I mean, we're always talking about, like, really cool cinematography shots. And the intro and just, like, how it starts off is really cool. So.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So
how did you find out about this movie to begin with, Mike?
Oh. Like, I've had a, like, on and off love affair with cinema, which I feel like is somewhat typical, but is, like, really sort of personal journey for each person. Mm. So, you know, when my attention went on to, like, long shots, this movie, obviously, the mm-hmm. opening scene is a classic. How could you think it's anything else, right? The other part of it, sort of wanting to find where film noir had a lot of, like, sort of things escaping their own genre, you know, like as a teenager, I got into Blade Runner and I, like, found out what neo-noir was. And then I was like, well, how did film noir sort of, like, build its own ecosystem the way that, like, rock and roll has or mm-hmm. something like that. But film noir is much more bespoke, you know, mm-hmm. like, it's this really narrow, like, okay, it's a pot boiler, whatever it's called, hard boiled crime. Like, you know, like, I wanted to see a weird take on that. And there's a lot of Orson Welles in that, like this, The Third Man, you right. know, all of that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. Like for me, Orson Welles, I always see him as Citizen Kane.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because he literally is Citizen Kane. Yes. He's more of an invisible force in Magnificent Ambersons, but like in Citizen Kane, he's very,
Yes. So, and I know, Diego, you haven't seen Citizen Kane.
Correct.
So this was your first Orson Welles movie?
Yes, it was. I've never seen an Orson Welles
movie. And this is quite a doozy because, like, before we even.
Quite.
Yeah, because he plays a piece of shit the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
He's just so good at being like, what a level of awareness. Like, oh, I just like gained a bunch of weight. I just like look unhealthy. Like, was what that am like I
his?
Do?
Yeah. So why don't you guys kind of tell me where this follows within his like discography? Compared to, was Citizen Kane like at the more of a height of his like career?
That was his first movie, right?
Yeah. Well, so his career went across media. So he got into radio.
Right.
He did this sort of War of the Worlds performance that this is the infamous like, oh, people called in and thought they were really being invaded.
People freaked out.
This was like the introduction to World of the Worlds too. Like he's...
Yeah, it was known to like sci-fi fans, which were like children essentially that were like weird. It was very... Yes. Not normalized the way sci-fi is upfront.
Oh man, it was my. I remember reading that book in fifth grade.
Yeah, it's a great book to read in fifth grade. Like very much, H.G. Wells is like you're allowed to imagine a better world. Like forward, like you can't help but love H.G. Wells' sense of wonder. But so Orson Welles took that and basically, you know, he's got this Pinky in the Brain voice, you know, like this timbre. Mm-hmm. So he went on as a like news anchor. He presented the War of the Worlds story as if he was the news anchor throughout the story.
As if it was happening right now.
Yeah, like in the present tense, like very...
I bet we can easily find that online too.
Easily.
Yeah.
And I listened to it, I think, for like the 100th anniversary.
Yeah.
It was in the 30s, right?
How long?
Maybe not. Yeah. Maybe like 75th or 80th anniversary. Anyways, I listened to it and I'm like, I could see why people freaked out.
Yeah.
It sounds pretty realistic.
Because I feel like I could listen to this like a podcast. Like, I could like work and it's then just YouTube. Like...
Yeah, I'm like what's the show that's directed by the Mr. Robot director, but it's like based on a podcast that's like all audio.
Couldn't tell you.
Dr. Death.
I can't remember it, but it evoked that feeling of like, oh, like audio as a storytelling medium, not in imitation of text. Like this is interesting. It was done through like voicemails and that sort of thing. But anyway, I wanted to go back to Orson Welles and like who this guy was. You know, he started out his life jumping around, living in a million places, and he had almost no friends. And he would basically put on Shakespeare plays by himself and play all the roles and get really into all the roles.
Nice.
And get really into blocking and arrangement like himself. You know, and he's like 12 and he's like reading King Lear.
Mm-hmm.
So he brought a lot of a sense of theater. And I think he brought theater in the wider like cross-genre sense of how theater desires to eliminate everything but the medium itself and make the medium feel real and emphasize the fact that people are alive. Mm-hmm. You know, theater is very much a medium that has a heartbeat. There's no heartbeat in the recording you're listening to. There's a heartbeat in the live show, you know.
Yep.
And theater is like, how do we take the fact that it's live and redirect it on something that is rehearsed? You know, and I think Orson Welles brought that to radio. He brought that to film. You know, he talks about how, have you heard about how Citizen Kane was made or like why it was so wild?
Please tell me.
Okay. So
I know a little bit.
So there's a million YouTube videos of like, we watched one before this movie very briefly of Orson Welles, you know, kind of like strung out on bourbon and cigars talking about like Churchill and the like wonderment of life or whatever.
One time I met Hitler, he was
that one, like I met Hitler and he was boring. And it's like, how are you going to deflate fascism as an ideology to like reveal that it makes you forgettable? Like what an oddly like astute way to combat glory as a vice, you know.
I think it also just felt a little performative for him to
Oh, 100%.
Just put him down. Like, yeah. It was like, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It was very much his theater. He's very theatrical and like, okay. You know, he's like almost playing a version of himself in these interviews. But yeah. So
he's some heavy hitters. Unforgettable.
Like, yeah. he's just like every little consonant comes out as a well-rounded Andy mm-hmm. Warhol painting, mm-hmm. you know,
it's like, probably why he has that rhythm in his voice too. It's just like, he's just like
the timbre of but mm-hmm. and when, but oh, you know what? And I was going to watch this. There's a video on, I believe it's, what's it called? Every Frame of Painting. They yes. have a thing where they intersplice Orson Welles and South Park and how they use the same storytelling beats
what?
Of like okay. the but then or meanwhile. And he's like showing how like it was an F for fake by Orson Welles, but then they're also showing like a South Park episode, you know, and how right. the beats are kind of similar and like both artists kind of stick to that very closely. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing I was originally getting at though was when they gave one of these interviews and he's like, they're like, how'd you get away with all this wild experimental stuff on your first movie, Citizen Kane? And he was like, well, simply nobody told me it couldn't be done. So I demanded it be done and I told them how it should be done. And I had a cameraman and he was wonderful. He was unafraid of failing. So he tried all of it or whatever. And it's like, and he's trying to make a case for like how you shouldn't let technology limit your imagination. And as a programmer, I see a lot of programmers do that. But it's also this idea of like, maybe approach everything like it's your first time, because he did with a lot of skill and a great artistic eye. So he's mm-hmm. walking in with that, whatever, but he wants it to not resemble theater. You're like, oh, he's a theater guy. He's going to walk in with theater,
right?
But he's walking in with this. What can the camera do? How can the camera be as organic as all of us are in theater? You know, that's what I think he brings to Citizen Kane, and you see it in the rest of his work.
Orson Welles is a true innovator, because like before Citizen Kane, all the films of like the 1950s were like shot like flat, as if they were trying to recreate theater. Because like you said, theater, there's a heartbeat to it. I've seen many Broadways, and like they're feeding off of the audience mm-hmm. feeding off of the cast. Like there's a symbiotic relationship going on. It's very much alive.
Yeah.
And but if you were to just look at the theater, it's like it's a stage. Everyone's presence, you know, everyone's
it's very two-dimensional with layers, right?
So like to so there's this new invention called cinema, like, oh, so they would just recreate what they see on the stage and everything's flat, everything's in focus. And with Orson Welles, especially with this film, The Touch of Evil, he's very innovative with like the camera movements and what he's focusing in, you know, the blocking, mm-hmm. you know, the mm-hmm. whole composition that he's painting.
Yeah.
In these frames, it's just absolutely beautiful. There's many times where I said a little bit tongue in cheek, but like I meant it like, wow, that was a perfect shot right there. Like,
the way
everyone was standing. And when you were saying like when he was doing Shakespeare by himself, like, positioning everybody, it's like, well, you mm-hmm. could see it as an adult when he's, you know,
his blocking.
This movie.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. his blocking is fantastic of where he positions everyone.
Why don't we talk about like what blocking is though? Like why it's important within cinema, and how this movie also, you know, was a standout for this technique.
Yeah. So blocking broadly is one of those things that's in both sort of theater and film. Mm-hmm. It's essentially where you position the cast. Okay. So kind of what Armand was getting to, of how like a theater is essentially, you know, even though we're all three dimensional beings, mm-hmm. everybody's kind of looking from this perspective of the audience. So you, mm-hmm. you block in a very 2D way. You block as if you're doing a Super Nintendo cutscene, right? Like where you get maybe layers, mm-hmm. but you're thinking about how those layers become a foreground and a background.
You're looking at the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And in cinema, it's a bit trickier because like when they filmed things in the 30s, you were saying about like how it was basically filmed like theater. Blocking was very much, where do you put the two or three people that are in a given shot on a screen?
There was also a scene in the movie too, where there was like there was Orson Welles all the way in the distance. And then the two other detectives like on this nice, perfect angle.
Yes.
And then here comes the protagonist kind of perfectly taking in
Charlton Heston,
like coming in on the on the opposite side. And just kind of blocking.
Perfectly
and then
balanced.
Literally, even, you know, was talked into, you know, like, all right, told one of the detectives, like, yeah, let's go. And then they go in the opposite direction.
Yes.
So you feel like this triangle almost, like kind of just mm-hmm. being visualized.
The geography yes. of that scene is, yeah, it's very fantastic. Cool. You yeah. know exactly where everyone is at any given time.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, like, there was a bridge at the ending. It totally yeah. makes sense. Look, you know, just just the architecture of like, ah, couldn't have been done without the perfect shape. You know what I mean?
Oh, so, yeah. That's yeah. fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. That's this wine's also fantastic.
Is that a good wine?
Would you yeah. like some more?
Yes. Would you like to say what kind of wine we're drinking?
This is Mike's wine, so Mike, what we got?
Oh man, I don't even know which bottle either, you so. Opened. Oh, Domaine Baron de la Huse. I actually have no idea what.
It says magnifique, monsieur.
And it literally just says red wine on the back.
Oui. C'est vrai.
Where is? I guess that's the barony. I don't know where this is though. I'm embarrassed. I know nothing of the wine I have. I actually,
no, it just tastes good.
You know, every mm-hmm. time I go there, I ask them, like, give me a wine that is like a story. And then the last time I went, it was like God. Super Bowl Sunday. And for some reason, everyone wanted wine. And I was like, okay, it's crowded. I don't have time to talk. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we're mm-hmm. going to find out. Maybe it was later than Super Bowl Sunday. There was a big TV event going on, though.
Oscars?
Yeah, I was about to say
Oscars. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's basically, it's like Super that's Bowl fun. Sunday for cinemaphiles. That's, yes, you know,
yes. Could totally skip it though.
Yeah, I did skip it. Yeah, I didn't want to actually because I was.
We're
like,
living in the good timeline because yeah. Everything Everywhere All at Once won Best Picture and Brendan Fraser won Best Actor.
Oh, so yeah.
Michelle Yeoh did they won Best Actress.
It? Yeah.
Did they finally get it? Like, did they? They was got it good? It. Okay. And we're just waiting for the Emmys to catch. Not the Emmys.
And Short Round won Best yeah. Supporting Actor.
It's not oh, Oscars. Yeah. Some Grammys. We're just waiting for the Grammys to catch up.
Oh, yeah. Grammys but, are... I'm not going to count on the Grammys.
But what don't about the VMAs? I'm making a joke. It didn't land.
The lightning anyways. Went off crickets, right crickets, when you said crickets. That.
Yeah, like, I, yeah, okay. There was lightning.
What about the,
yeah.
What about the VMAs? Jesus.
Yeah. You know, Cy, that's on. You know.
Yeah, right, right.
But going back, I want to go back to the entire, you know, Touch of Evil topic.
Yes.
I feel like a lot of Touch of Evil is almost like the ideal career of an artist in reverse because, you know, he started out with Citizen Kane and Magnificent Ambersons. He got this great contract for that, right? He got the ability to make it whatever he wanted in Citizen Kane and Magnificent Ambersons, and they punished him for it. They went back on the contract under Magnificent Ambersons. They cut it up. They edited it. And you look at the rest of his career, and it's probably at like half the height of those first two movies. I mean, this was, they basically wanted a B movie, as I understand it. They have a, this was essentially going to be a B movie, or it was yeah. marketed as one. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you watch this, and you're like, wow, I wish the like mail it in low budget, like crime films looked this good today. You know,
that
like,
I think that's the other thing is that I haven't seen a lot of noir films, and I mm-hmm. can't quite like, pin this as like whether this is good or bad or really even like what are tropes of the genre and how this bends that.
Well, you
I don't
know,
think it was bending or it was commenting on the noir because like it was still relatively new because mm-hmm. noir was like 30s and 40s and this is like late 50s. So it's
no, this
like
is early, isn't it? It's I thought it was between 52 and 55.
I thought it was during the war.
During wait this
film,
movie.
No.
Oh, film noir. Like, yeah, you're right. Noir. Film noir orbits around the 40s. So yes. A little before, a little after. Mm-hmm. Like,
and this is 1958. So this is like late
oh, it's
50s.
58. Okay. Yes. I thought it was like 52, but it's still compared to a lot of just, I'll put it this way, Diego. There's a whole lot of movies not worth seeing anymore from that era because they're so plain that there's such a fight to become even like mediocre today as like a film that you watch a movie. And even if it's bad, at least it's thrilling or artistic or, mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes it's fun because it's violent and because they couldn't make movies like violent, they couldn't make them sexual. They couldn't make them like intense in any other way. They were, even the comedies weren't that great. There was such a like, you know what I mean? There was such a static ocean of mediocrity to me. Dude. Like there's a lot of great films, but in terms of percentage, oh,
so 50. So that's like yeah. this puritanical McCarthyism-esque.
I mean, it's like puritanical compared to the 60s. Yeah, but we got to remember that the 50s saw themselves as like the most liberal time up to that point, right? Well. They saw themselves very much on that old, like, yeah, liberalism is anti-communism and it's turning a blind eye to whatever we did in Latin America and, like, you know, all for the fruit company or whatever. Like, there was a complaint that William F. Buckley made in the 50s of, we are living in the most liberal era. And he was a conservative. He was one of the people that was eventually going to be the architect to bringing Ronald Reagan in. But at the time he was complaining that he was like, intellectually, there are no intellectual conservatives left. They're all different intellectual liberals, like in terms of justice, in terms of like all these things. Like it was almost like on the eve of the 60s revolution, the old world liberals claimed victory. And when they did, people kind of realized the limit of it. Like even having the Republicans be like pro-business, pro-cop, but for the 50s, a lot of them were pro-choice. Like the father of George H.W. Bush founded Planned Parenthood. Like, we got to remember there was this very elite kind of closed, like, you know, East Coast white liberalism that was very like market oriented, but it was liberal. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to contextualize it. And like, did these people, like, did they see themselves as like a fundamentally conservative force or a fundamentally like reforming force? And like, they saw themselves as reformers and revolutionaries in a way we kind of find like pathetic or funny today. Like, wow, this passed for liberalism. But in their world, you know,
it's always going to be constantly changing because like with progressivism, you're always going forward.
Well,
and I hate the phrase conservatism. It's like, what are you conserving?
Well,
because I feel like it's the same forces driving society forward. It's just conservatism is just progressivism driving the speed limit.
Yeah, I mean, you could be right, but I think a point you're bringing up there is that a person who is a conservative has a much narrower threshold for like
everything,
for things that are unresolved, right? Mm-hmm. Like they want that truth, they want that finality, and a lot of plurality is the fact that your narrative no longer gives you finality, and you have to accept that.
But how does that affect the film world? Because like we watch this movie, and like it does have some pretty dark undertones to it, but it's just referenced to. It's just touched upon.
Yeah,
like there's this one scene where it's like, I was like, okay, we're gearing up for this for like a while, and it's like when we finally get
yeah,
there,
you made that comment.
It's like we don't see it happen. It's like I feel like there's external forces influencing this, and you did reference it.
Yeah, so this was as the code was breaking down in the late 50s, early 60s. I would say like, I don't know, roughly between when TV got big in the mid 50s to like, I think around the time JFK got shot, there was still nominally a code in film. I believe it was the Hays Code, right? Or was the Hays Code the earlier one?
I don't know, to be honest.
I think it was called the Hays Code. Somebody might listen to this and be like, it wasn't the Hays Code. I'm like, okay, then you're right and I'm wrong and I don't know the name. But there was a code where there was a concern that film was seen as something very bawdy and sort of almost burlesque about it in the 20s and 30s. And we have
to... That's a dirty business.
Yeah, I mean, like, cinema was not considered an art until, like, well after World War II. It wasn't treated the way we treat it now. And this was also an era that did not treat anything that was not classical as art in music. Like, this was before jazz was considered the, like, classy, aristocratic, complex music. It was still considered... I mean, you hear it in the movie. Yes. It's used to reference people of ill intent arriving, like this jazz music starts playing, but I think
smoking doobies. Oh my god, how could they? The reefer, and the jazz music.
They put reefer before heroin as like the dangerous drug. Did you see that?
Yes, where
they're
1950s.
Like, they're like reefer, but also heroin, but whatever about the heroin. Right. But there is reefer.
It was also set in Mexico, and back then that was the justification. There's this new drug called marijuana.
Oh yeah, and
coming from Mexico.
And the two demographics that commonly perpetually smoked marijuana were Latino and Black people. Like, and so you when there's also a dog whistle thing going on here of where they say, you know, like, oh, I think he's a drug addict. The association was like, oh, white people get drugs from minorities of color. Like, that was when like Orson Welles' character makes that remark, it seems like a stretch and you're watching it like, who would fucking buy that? But it's like, oh, that's such an accepted narrative at the time. Like, mm-hmm. you can just say, oh, it doesn't matter. He's a Mexican cop in like the cabinet of Mexico. He probably does drugs and he probably got his wife into drugs. Mm-hmm. And like, right. you know, that's sort of like, I don't know. I guess
you're absolutely right. Because like yeah. at the core of this story, we have Charlton Heston's character. He's playing this high up federale agent. Yeah. And like, mm-hmm. he's married to an American woman and she's white.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
like, you have like, that dichotomy going on, but let's summarize the movie before, because I feel like we're crouching into the movie.
Yeah, I'm dragging this all over the place.
So who, Diego, Mike?
Yeah.
Who would like to summarize the plot of The Touch of Evil? As Mike and Diego look at each other, it's like a standoff.
I guess I'm just honest. This is just actually
a Mexican standoff.
There's a lot going on. Are you like worried you're going to mix up? That's okay.
No, I'm actually just trying to think of in the intro, the first ever crime. I'm like, how did that start off again? Like, I'm just trying to remember.
Like, someone planted a bomb right. on the businessman's car.
And was the businessman related to?
This is a great summary.
Yeah.
So what it's nominally like the crime that happened is like sort of the yeah. B story. So
right.
it's not really important. It's you get it right.
Yeah. yeah. It sets up the dirty cop.
It sets up the world.
The big conflict yeah. of the movie is the ideological conflict between Vargas and, oh my God, I just call him Orson Welles. Captain Quinn, right? So yeah, so there's like an ideological divide, and that crime introduces that conflict. I think it's like by the time they get to the end of the movie, and I'm not gonna like give away the bigger part about the end of the movie, but the crime is a very marginal thing, and even when they bring up its relevance, it's almost ironically done at the end of like, well, that doesn't matter anymore. The like rotten nature of Quinlan's heart has sort of been yes. you know, laid out flat for all to see, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like, yes. mm-hmm. yeah,
absolutely.
So essentially the crime in the beginning is just like how Vargas and Hank or Miguel and Hank run into each other.
Yeah.
You got it. Thank yeah. you.
I mean, like it also sets up the fact that like, you know, a lot of this has to do with sort of Grandy. I'm going to get his name wrong, but Grandy. So Grandy is essentially tied to the previous case essentially as a bias against Vargas, right?
Right.
Because his brother is involved in the whole thing.
Yes.
And what ends up happening is he sort of, the reason Quinlan gets assistance, you know, the more I'm explaining this, the more I'm thinking, no, that isn't a prelude. That's the entire movie is these two stories constantly intertwining.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because you have Vargas against Quinn, and then yeah. the B story is Vargas's wife,
mm-hmm.
and yeah. I guess this is a gang of Mexican guys, which is then connected to...
Oh, don't forget the LGBT representation. It was their idea of lesbians. Did you see that?
No.
Their idea of gay women. Yeah,
yeah, there was. So the women that also went into the room at the same time.
Yeah, it's like, who has reefer? Like, gay people and Mexicans. That's the implication.
Oh, okay.
That's gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah, the implication. That's the 1950s. Yeah, the implication. It's like... and you don't know. That's. I think there's like a narrative question in the movie of like, how much is Orson Welles co-opting this and how much is he winking at the audience of like, oh, like just kind of like Quinlan, like we can write this off as an explanation, you know, like that like sexual minorities and like racial minorities are the reason that drugs are crossing the border.
Mm-hmm. Do you know? I just feel like that's just a byproduct of 1958. Like, I don't think he was perpetuating that stereotype. It was just like,
yeah, I didn't really.
I didn't think he was perpetuating it, but I didn't know if like.
I felt like it was a vehicle for the story, you know.
I almost though I got like a vibe that I got in Crash where it's like part of this narrative is doing one thing and part of it's doing another thing. Like,
okay.
On one hand,
I didn't really feel like. Sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah. No. Go ahead.
No, it was just I never really noticed that because it just felt like such a subplot. It just kind of yeah. felt like it was accurate to the time. You know what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
So that's just what I thought.
No, and I guess you bring up a point of
a
like
perspective of the time, should I say?
Yeah, and the movie's very much veiled in a like very caricature like sort of thing. Like,
especially with Quinn. Oh my god. Oh yeah. Yeah. Diego was saying, like, good villain. Like a cartoon character.
Yeah.
There was a few times where I was having trouble like taking him seriously because he was like so bad.
Yeah, where he's like such a piece of garbage. Who plays his like implied ex-lover?
Quinn?
Yeah, the woman.
Oh, with the dark
is that Marlene Dietrich? Is that Marlene Dietrich?
I thought it was Sophia Loren for a second.
No. But you're thinking of the other person with Sophia. No. Who was this?
All the dudes look the same. All the women look the same. I was like, is that Charlton Heston? Oh, no.
It's just because it's a black and white movie, too, I feel like.
And
I
all think the that's actors, was... like, it's kind of like The Bachelor. All the bachelors look the same.
Oh, yeah.
They're all, like, white dudes, brown hair, a little bit of stuff.
Heteronormativity, man.
Yes. I am waiting for, I guess, like, a black bachelor. I'm pretty certain they did that already. But, like,
wait, it was Zsa Zsa Gabor?
I want a bi bachelor. We're way off topic. I want a bi bachelor. I was like, you want to really ruffle some feathers? Put some dudes in The Bachelor. And he's like, well, you know,
that would
well,
be nice.
Let's see.
That would be cool, a bi bachelor.
And then like, that could add so many dimensions of conflict. Oh. Like we should copyright that and then just do what everyone does in 21st century capitalism. Like, you know, collect the depiction.
They did a bachelorette with two girls. They weren't like dating each other, but it was like, two people. I was like, listen, go all the way. Have a mixed bag.
I wonder what that's like. Because then now
their ratings skyrocket. Well, like, their ratings
what if you had all poly people, but they're all also astronomers? So it's called the constellation, but it's like an ironic self-reference.
And then there's like different kinds. You know, there is like, I think there's like a Spanish dating show that has like a lot of
Manor.
Astrological references.
I could see that.
I don't know what it's called, but yeah.
MILF Manor.
I don't know.
you know about MILF Manor?
I don't know what streaming service that's on.
No. So. Is there? Wait, stop. Is there really?
We don't know about it?
No.
Okay. Then we'll get back to Touch of Evil.
You have this postured way. You're like, well, you haven't heard of MILF Manor. That's unacceptable. Like,
yes. Like, wait, what?
Listen. Okay. MILF Manor. This is the premise. So there's like, say like eight dudes and then there's eight older women. All of the contestants that are guys.
Yeah.
Those are their moms.
No.
So all the dudes are like dating each other's mom. And there's this one. You want to get more depraved about it?
Yes.
There's this one like exercise that they're doing on the show. I don't watch a show. But like the woman had to like massage the contestants and figure out based on the body.
No.
Which one was their son.
Freud was right.
Anime was a mistake.
No.
Reality.
Reality
shows are a mistake.
Yo, okay.
I feel like reality TV is like, okay, we see all these narratives through like all these lenses. And reality TV is like, can we just get rid of like the lens of it having a plot, the lens of time? We just want the lens of television. With very generous editing that invents a story. Like if Tarkovsky said that like cinema is sculpting time, then reality TV is just like the guy with the chainsaw cutting the log into a bear, like, but churning out 100 of them. Those are the editors of reality TV. That is what the sense of time, you know, being sculpted is. Time has been sculpted into a narrative for the most inane, forgettable people.
And with the Touch of Evil, I think it sculpted time very well.
It was Shakespearean about, you know, essentially a murder involving like a local crime lord on the border. You know?
Right. And that's just, like you said, that's just the backdrop. So like the driving force or the inciting incident, there was a car bomb. It goes off on the border of U.S.-Mexico border.
Yes.
And we have the sheriff of Texas trying to investigate and also the federale agent, Charlton Heston, also trying to investigate. So like there's crossing of streams going on. Mm-hmm. So that's the point of contention. And it's kind of like, and as I was watching it, I'm like, okay, is Quinn Orson Welles' character out of his jurisdiction because he's in Mexico?
I think they make it gray because they keep showing how both of them just act like cops. They're entitled to their authority regardless of where they are.
Right.
And I don't think the movie really questions like if cops acting like they have unlimited jurisdiction is a betrayal of like sort of the virtues of a republic of limited government. Because I think that's kind of become a much more like contemporary question of like, the cool action cop in a movie that gets justice done anywhere. Like, yeah. Well, are you really like, is a teacher allowed to give her kid a detention when they run into each other at a grocery store? Like, we have something against overstepping jurisdiction that very recently, it's just funny to see in a movie like this, like the wrong thing about them is not that they overstep, because everyone does that. The virtuous ones.
Even Vargas?
Yeah, I mean, he acts like a cop up in Texas, the way he's treating people, the way he's demanding answers, the way he's like...
I'm not a cop, I'm just a concerned man.
Yeah.
He's like, he's just a private eye?
Well, I mean, they leave it ambiguous. They basically behave while lacking the legitimacy of this authority.
They seem like detectives, so but they're also law enforcement, because there's that line where it's like, the cops... Well, totalitarianism is like the cop's dream, because like the cop is in charge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But like democracy is like... Law.
Yeah, what
in
is it? Is it Max Weber who says that for authority you need two of the three? It's like authority of legitimacy, right? Which is like somebody who's in power gave me power, simplest one.
Right.
Then you have like authority of capability or ability, mm-hmm. which is like, oh, you know how to like lay the brick wall, you're the bricklayer, or like you know how to organize the team, you're the team lead, right? Yes. And then you have charismatic authority, which is people like you and they give you that. And I think what they kind of reveal here is that police tend to have, at least the ones that would do something this brash, they have both that capable authority and the charismatic authority. By charismatic, maybe they're not liked, but people just accept that they are that force and behave accordingly. Yeah.
Figure of the authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. The police state thrives and the cop is in charge rather than the law.
Yeah. And it's sort of a question of why are you driven to like, the way that justice is driven for you affects what you see as a legitimate pursuit of it.
Right.
And you see that where Quinlan is, and here's a spoiler alert. So just
full you know, spoilers yeah, here on out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So Quinlan turns out to be right. And it turns out that he actually did plant evidence on the guilty guy, but he does it in such a crappy way. And it's like so blatantly, like everything's against the guy. Like, you know, Charlton Heston's character Vargas, he's like, well, you know, you're like, you think you're being racist. And he's like, no, you're racist. You're racist because you're acting like a cop and you're in Texas and like, oh, I'm an American. And it's like the most frenzied defense. And so you have like no respect. He's not the Quinlan's not the anti-hero planting evidence on the really bad guy, even though it turned out that he was. He planted evidence on a murderer. But you see this guy panicking and he's just like anyone else who's like,
yeah,
caught up in that, and you empathize with them, and it's kind of revealing that corruption it breeds a lack of respect for justice, because it can breed empathy for the guilty, you
right.
know,
right? Because like he was guilty, but like not in the way he was caught type of thing, because like right. Quinn planted the evidence, and a good cop wouldn't do that. And Vargas, who is our archetypal good cop, because like we have Vargas who's like the good cop, and then Quinn's who's the bad cop,
yeah,
good cop, bad cop. And it's like, well, that's not right.
Like, yeah, it's.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I like kind of, I don't know. I like when I first watched this, I just like winced at that whole scene, because I honestly thought that like Quinlan was just going to shoot the dude or something. Like it didn't turn out to be as bad.
Another scene.
But yeah.
Like everything that could go wrong with this guy did go wrong.
Yeah.
Kills somebody, plants evidence, lies.
Yeah.
Almost like.
We're watching his demise, really.
Yeah.
We caught it at the right time.
Okay. He's like disintegrating. Yeah.
I'm glad you two said that. Especially you, Diego, because like film noir, The way it works is that the detective goes into the underworld.
Mm. Okay. Are you going to go into Hero's Journey?
No.
Oh, I was like ready. I was like,
I don't think there is a Hero's Journey in this movie, but like, I was wondering, I was like, where's the descent? Is the descent essentially Tijuana or whatever this is? Is it the setting? But I think it's Quinn's character because like he's, I don't know, he's like this upstanding guy in his community. Like his peers respect him, but it's actually, he's a piece of shit. And he cuts all these corners, screws over all these people, presumably innocent people along the way. And it's like, is his character descending into the darkness? That commentary on film noir? I don't know.
Well, I think it shows a descent as a 1-2 punch, right? They first depict that a person finds themselves in an environment they don't want to be, and then they're left to their choices of how to deal with that, right?
So we're like, talking about Quinlan. Correct.
Well, yes. But they show that that's the theme of the movie. If you notice, almost every character gets surrounded by a hostile crowd and often more than once. And they show how capable or incapable or how moral or immoral like the given character is being surrounded by a hostile crowd or audience.
I don't think it's necessarily hostile. I think he just kind of feels like, because when he went back to that bar that was in the town where he knew and he was meeting up with an ex lover, like he's clearly have like been there before, and it almost is as if since he had like not been there in some time that maybe he himself was just like nervous to operate within like this community because he has a personal love interest. Obviously that's, I don't really think he really has, clearly he doesn't have that much respect for her, right? Because he's like just finally reaching out, just finally seeing her again. And I don't know, maybe in a weird way, maybe that did also kind of like put him off his game,
right?
Because he's like, this is his place where he, you know, where he almost can get away with anything, you know what I mean? So
he thinks he's above the law.
Yes
But he does have an urgent need to actually pursue justice. Like, he just,
the farce. I mean, like, you know, and in his own twisted way. Well, and from his perspective.
I mean, think about it this way. Like, he basically gets a lot of these guilty parties in a position where they're essentially helpless, and he still pursues justice, which sort of leaves him as a person not feeling threatened, but he's either corrupt or he's following justice down to like the most minute level because the person stops being a threat and he's still interested. And so I think narrowing it down to that, you know, at first you think, okay, so he has to be corrupt and guilty. And then it turns out he was right. So then it sort of raises the question, well, at least one time he was pursuing justice down to a minute degree outside of the law in a very sort of anarchistic way. Maybe anarchism is supposed to have no coercive authority. Maybe that's not the right word, but he's going out on his own and he's doing this. And it's obviously a thing that is virtuous even in a vacuum for him to like get to really finish off a person he has judged as guilty. I mean, it, not to give him too much credit, but Quinlan sort of feels like somebody that finds out the person they like canceled didn't actually do something that bad, but they still said something horrible or like almost as bad. And you're like, well, I don't feel bad saying the earlier thing. Like, they were still garbage. You know, that's very much the internal feeling and the internal logic he's working towards. To sort of give him to give him a bone there, you know.
But does he deserve that bone? I don't think so.
Fuck no. It's
because like, okay, so we have Orson Welles, who in this film he got big and fat, and he's like,
he has
this mug on his face the whole time. He's like,
he's just bloated.
And then we have Charlton Heston, who's like a very attractive man,
right?
Very trim, and it's like we have visually who we need to subconsciously root for and who are drawn towards.
Good comeback.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think Quinn, while it's overt that he's a bad guy, I mean, there are some moments where he's like humanized. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
A little bit of a complex character, but those are few and far between.
But
I would agree with that. I just don't really see, I don't know. I think from the beginning, they establish that he had ill intentions, whether it's, you know, and even like later in the movie, when they look at his past cases, he's like, yeah, no, he's been doing this. And like his partner has been on it, been in on it with him. I mean, I guess you could also ask the question, right? Who, almost in the question of like, who's right in war, You know what I mean?
It's I thought it was just more like compliance through incapability. You know, the way that a rotten actor in a system co-opts people not aware at their job or responsibility into working in his favor. Because he said his partner found all the evidence, right?
Yeah. Well, his partner approached him too. So you're like, yo, I found your cane on the, yeah.
Yeah, but he was, I mean, by that point, he went to Vargas first.
You did.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
look what I found. Well, I think he was more distraught. That was my interpretation. It's like, but this was like a revelation, like, oh my God, like he killed that man and tried to frame it.
But it's important. I think a lot of people who are distraught they sort of appeal to an authority of reconciling the reason they're distraught, right? And like so going to Vargas, there's a reason. It's not just another guy. It's like, oh my God, I'm distraught over evidence and you seem to be my resident authority of evidence because clearly you're doing a better job than my old authority on evidence. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you superseded him. Your idea of justice, like Vargas's idea of justice supersedes Quinlan's idea of justice, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No.
Right. Like, so let's talk about the film itself now. Because like when we sat down to watch this, I was like, okay, let's put on this version of it. And immediately.
Right. Yeah.
Mike, you were like, oh my God, I can't watch this.
No. Yeah, that's on point for me though. I'm looking at my notes like I didn't write down anything about this. I don't know why I'm looking at my notes.
I did actually write notes on this because I do remember like the total feeling difference. I felt it.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this movie was after Orson Welles, like I was saying earlier, he lost his like, you're a director, you get final cut privileges. And he was making sort of like B-level movies, or if they were an A-level movie, they got downgraded and marketed as B-level movies, right. Or he had to go to like West Germany or somewhere abroad to get his movie made later on, you know? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So at this point, he basically saw the studio cut after he was like, I'm done with the movie. The studio not only edited it, but like, I think added scenes or like added more shots or footage and like changed the sound a whole bunch. And he sent a whole bunch of notes about like, no, you did it all wrong. But with the edit you have now, here's how you have to change that to make it work. And he wrote like, what did they say? 58 pages?
89 pages, I think.
Okay. It was an enormous, it wasn't just, here's one, like our notes we took of like, you know, one page, you know,
right.
Maybe. Mine's three lines, like, but he gave a big, almost an artistic statement of how it ought to be modified. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So the edit you're watching, or the one we started watching second, we turned it on. That was the studio edit, you know, it's like not that good. And then we switched to the reconstructed, basically somebody took the version and they took his notes and they edited according to his notes. Mm-hmm, like I think in the, mm-hmm.
Was the intro like the biggest change essentially?
No. A whole, like a lot of really long shots were just cut.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Cause at Hollywood at the time, like all the shots were supposed to be between like 10 and 25 seconds. And he made them
I got to see the like studio, like with the version that's like easier to see. I just want to see the difference between the two.
It's very, I don't know, dude.
Is it like Justice League?
Yeah, oh, shit. I mean, I saw the first Justice League and I saw the 4-hour one, so I might as well just, you know, see this.
I don't know. I started watching the extended one and I'm like, it looks like they took a 2-star movie and made it a 2.5-star. And I could have been wrong, but I was like,
I must watch it in black and white. I was close.
Oh, man. I mean, here's the thing. I saw the non-director's cut Blade Runner and it's with Harrison Ford going like, she wasn't a replicant after all, and we had a white picket fence and lived happily. And he's like literally talking over this awful shot of them driving in a car, you know. Mm-hmm. Like,
and he did it bad on purpose so they wouldn't use it. They used it.
And then he and the director were like, well, this is trash. Let's not do this and like do it.
Like, yeah, fuck it. They're not even going to use it. They're like, yeah, it's fine.
It's like tears in rain. And then Harrison Ford's like, I don't know what the replicant was saying.
You know, it's funny because the studio ending of Blade Runner and the studio ending of Brazil like 3 years later. I don't know. Have you guys seen Brazil?
I've not seen Brazil.
I haven't seen it. It's like 1984 part two.
It's like 1984 meets Monty Python. It's very weird, but it's like horrific too. It's by the animator of Monty Python, but it's a live action movie. Mm-hmm. And it has the guy that plays Elizabeth's dad in Pirates of the Caribbean. He's like the villain in Tomorrow Never Dies. Jonathan Bryce Howard, I want to say. He's a Klein in Glengarry Glen Ross, what'd you say?
You heard me. I said. Sorry, guys. This is my voice acting career. You can't kill me, Jack. Anyway.
No, but it wasn't. wait, stop. This was not Jeffrey Rush, though. It was not, you can't beat me, Jack. Like, it was Elizabeth. every scene, he looks like he's about to get mugged. That like, you know,
I've seen him in other movies. I can't think of them.
Was he in Moulin Rouge?
Was he in Lord of the Rings?
You know who I'm talking about?
I've not seen Moulin Rouge.
Neither have I.
No.
You're not missing much.
I here's the thing. What's the name of the director?
You got Lars right. I forget.
Not Von Trier. It's the other one. No. Lars, I don't know, random name.
He did the new Elvis movie, which is a fucking nightmare to watch.
Oh, really? Oh, God. Oh, because he did Great Gatsby, and he did the Romeo and Juliet movie.
Yes. It's just like that, except on drugs.
I would watch him do a Deadpool movie.
Oh, my God.
That'd be
a lot.
I know.
Deadpool would be shooting people. There'd be like 50 angles of it.
Right. He wouldn't
say one word for like 30 minutes.
I need like every bullet to be, every like gunshot you hear from Deadpool to be a different shot. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, just over the shoulder.
Like a cha-ching, and then like a Mario noise. Like, just
with Doja Cat playing in the background.
Diego's so upset.
This is going off in so many different directions. Like, you know,
Diego had his direction he wanted to go in.
Yeah, I'm
we were like, Doja Cat and Mario. You're like, get out of here. This is my dream.
I was like, this is my dream.
Yeah. You're talking about Pirates of the Caribbean over there.
I mean, yeah.
But anyways, back to the Touch of Evil.
Yeah, back to the Touch of Evil after going over every other movie. Like, okay, what did you guys think of the motel clerk?
I don't know what they were going for.
He's a spy, like a rat, but at the same time,
I think he's
weird trope.
What do you think the trope was? I think it was...
Can I give a hot take?
Just give a hot take.
Yep, okay. Sure.
He was the foil to, or the reflection of Quinlan's partner. He was compliant in capability in another form.
Because he knew what was happening?
Yeah. I mean, he turns the radio off so he could hear what was going on.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's not clicking for me.
It's
so the loud music's playing and they're ganging up on his wife, the woman.
Yes.
And then he turns the radio off. Well, if they can hear everything on his end of the vent, he can hear everything on their end of the vent.
The walls are pretty thin that she can have a whispered conversation with the tenants on the other side.
Yeah. So he heard everything.
He heard it all. He knew what was happening.
Right. But did he talk to... Like, we're just saying, like, in a way, he was just, like, a bystander, almost like someone, like,
he was giving an air of legitimacy to the entire geographic situation and occurrence by being at his post, not ringing the alarm, like...
So he was essentially, like, you see something happen out in the world, you see a gaggle of people just run up with their phones out, ready to just capture the moment. That's him.
Yeah, but almost worse than that, he's the guy who... You know, he's like the clerk who stands near the door while something's going on in back.
That's not worse. That's literally the same thing. That's in which someone watches
he's
something.
He's not helping.
Right. They're not helping.
But a bystander has no authority where them behaving like they normally behave indicates safety or danger. But if you're the clerk and you're acting like nothing's going on, if someone pulled up to that motel and started asking questions, he would be there to get up, walk up in front and like talk, right? Like, and if he's talking, it means it's not an unsupervised motel. He's providing the difference between supervision and a lack of supervision, which essentially gives them a shield to do what they want. Right?
And he's obviously on Quinlan's side because Quinlan's partner was the one to drive up Vargas's wife to the motel.
Yeah.
And you know,
and also Grandy. I mean,
no one was there too.
Yeah. I wonder if they knew because Quinlan hadn't met Grandy yet, right? So maybe that was incidental.
Grandy is the wife's name?
Wait a minute. No, because Quinlan knew that his wife was at the hotel, which means that the partner told him, I put him at Grandy's hotel. Must have told him that off screen, right? Because we remember
her there.
Right, but you can wonder, did he know it was Grandy's place or not? But Orson Welles knew to bring up to him, do you know where your wife is? Like, he knew she was in danger. How did he know she was in danger? Because the guy knew he was dropping her off at a dangerous place, you know? At least that's the way I interpret it, you know?
Mm-mm.
You're sitting there like, oh, man.
And then, like, all I can think of is when the, when his partner just is like, oh, I found this cane. And I was like, yeah, you thought that was going to save you. Okay. Guy.
Well, he redeemed himself. Okay. Even if he was complicit the whole time, he redeemed himself by the end of the movie.
Yeah. I feel like you're only required morally to change the amount of complicity you actually provide. Like, he wasn't about to become a great investigator after literally using his bad investigative techniques for, like, sort of, you know, providing an air of legitimacy to Quinlan. He's not, I mean, he wasn't pretending to be a bad investigator. He just was. He's not going to get good because he's on the right side now, you know? Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Here's my hot take.
Okay. I'm ready.
This movie was filmed beautifully. Yeah. Like, it, for the time, like, yeah. I just thought it was reminiscent of a movie that would be made now, like same techniques, like it's very timeless.
Yeah,
even though it is black and white, like it feels like it would be made, you know, nowadays almost.
Yeah.
But the thing that really bothered me about this movie was the pacing. I don't mind slow movies, but like this was, it felt stop and go. Like the movie had a good pace going on, and then it came to a standstill, and I'm like,
it reminded me of American Gothic. Just like that style where like it almost feels like every scene is like a stage play. And it's probably very like on brand for, it has to be on brand for Orson, right? So,
well, I mean, it's more like a product of his time. I feel like he intersperses more modern shots and more modern pacing with an otherwise contemporary pacing, an otherwise contemporary style of shots, like
conventional.
Yeah, he has like the cars driving in the desert and nobody else was doing that. And that's really cool. And the movie picks up and then it goes back to like mid-range shot dialogue where everyone's facing the camera, which is what every other movie was kind of doing at the time. I mean, even like 12 Angry Men, where it's like, ooh, it was a teleplay and it was realistic acting. Still everyone's facing the camera, still old-fashioned blocking, still everything learned in the golden age of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Dare I say it could have gotten trimmed down. Like, an hour, 45 minutes.
Which is why I'm curious about the first one we were supposed to see.
The theatrical cut, was 90 minutes.
The problem that I've heard about it, because I haven't seen the whole thing, is that a lot of it is like, oh, let's get rid of the really short and really long shots and sort of make them all medium length, which people don't really do anymore. We do either short shots, 2 to 5 seconds, or we do very long shots.
I feel like the issue was more so the script. Like, it was like repeating itself and telling us information that if you're watching the movie, you would have picked up on.
Like, but you have a very mature sense of media consumption. Like,
I mean, for this type of film.
Yeah, because I was going to say, too, I feel like the to your point of the script where I did kind of want this to be almost a little bit shorter. Like, I guess maybe
pick up the pacing, trim the dialogue. Like for that one scene where they find the shoebox, like, oh, the camera looks at the shoebox. Oh, it's empty.
Yeah.
And then the same scene. I found 2 sticks of dynamite in this. And then we have our main character, Vargas, like, wait a minute. I looked at that. That was empty 10 minutes ago. You couldn't have put in those sticks of dynamite in there. It was empty. You framed him. And I'm like, we know this already.
Mm-hmm. I did kind of like that.
Could have been like, oh, my God, you framed him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just could have looked at the dynamite like, wait a minute. You.
But I mean, that's like a very efficient storytelling style. Like if you miss that, you miss that whole story beat. And as a result, we've been able to put more into a plot at a time. But you
why stop the movement, the pacing for those that aren't paying attention to the movie? You shouldn't take it.
It's not that. It's that sometimes people don't put into their head what is going on until it's been drilled in three different ways. And I've known a lot of, you know, like older people who watch movies. They sort of, what's the word? They can't follow a lot of newer films. The amount of people I knew over 50 who said, I don't have any idea what's going on in Everything Everywhere at Once, or Into the Spider-Verse, or a whole slew of these movies that, you know, we're like, oh, that's cute and fun. But I mean, a lot of people I knew who were they're our age or younger kind of thought that Everything Everywhere at Once dragged in the middle and the end. And they're like, this stuff was said too many times. And the generation in there that would have been alive when Touch of Evil was made, they were like, I had no idea what was happening even before she got the earpieces. Like, there were too many events, too much was going on. And I've heard this for other things too, like watching Fleabag or whatever. Where I haven't heard it is really slow shows like Mad Men or Breaking Bad, where each story piece is like, oh my God, this is 2 or 3 minutes long.
But aren't those like dialogue heavy shows?
I mean, but there's a lot of very stoic dialogue in the shows where like you make a statement and then people spend time reacting. And yeah, true, here that wasn't done. It was just they kept reiterating the point. But I think it still all points to somebody who doesn't really have a, I don't know. They didn't, it's almost like a movie made for somebody who didn't grow up with movies, you know?
I mean, I understand this movie was cutting edge for the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, you have to give it some leniency, but like, I felt like we were going in circles sometimes.
Yeah. No, it
was a very hypnotic movie. Like it felt like it very much felt like a Sunday movie. And yeah. I did kind of feel like, it did almost kind of feel like a rule of threes within a video game, where it was like, you just kind of see the same thing, but iterative, like, you know, a different iteration every time. And I was like, okay, cool. I totally get it. I wonder how this movie would have done in color, though, only just to help with this pacing, to help with like all of the like different kinds of more like.
I think it would have taken away.
You
from
think
it.
So?
Because the composition is so. It was made for black and white. Okay. Everything with like the color and the shadows and like if it was colorized.
That's something you always have to think about too, is that like how does a range of contrast compare to like multiple hues and value, you know.
And I think they could have filmed it like Breaking Bad if it was in color because.
It felt like that, right? Because at some points like when the mirror scenes and whatnot, but it felt really like it was like visually amusing to watch, like very easy to watch.
Yes.
And compared, we should have probably watched like contemporary films before this. Cause I feel like we're also sort of, I mean, it's like, I am going to judge it by the contemporary era. Obviously I live in 2023, but there's like an amount of charity, like, because I've watched a lot of like silent films where it literally is like what you were saying, Armand, like, the theater layout and the shot is way too long. And you're like, why do we have to have this long of a conversation?
Everything's in focus.
Yeah.
Short focal range.
Yeah. Everything looks like a headshot from the mall. Like, it's just like, thanks. We needed this. And like every like beat and switch is really lame and really slow. So I feel like maybe I am forgiving it too much and I actually don't enjoy a lot of that. And I'm just like refusing to acknowledge it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't blame you. I don't, because like visually stunning, awesome, beautiful. My issue is just the storytelling. It could have been more tight.
Yeah. It meanders.
I don't think boring is like a really nice way to put it, but I just felt like it was, I think Armand was right, where it was just like, feeling a little slow.
You looked bored.
Oh, well.
you were getting angry at the movie a couple of times. You're like, oh.
Oh, I mean, like, I mean, you know, it's just mostly because the just a classic thing of like just seeing like the clear like just portrayal of like one person to another and people just completely being in on it is that sucks, you know, because at the end of the day, it's kind of like, what about this person? Like they're clearly wrong. And I obviously you want to see Vargas's voice like be heard. Cause like, yo, this is not right. So I think like, I don't know. Sometimes when I see stuff like that, it's just like, I mean, I know we're waiting for the resolution, right? That's the point of the plot in the movie. But sometimes in the moment I'm just like, man, fuck that. So, yeah.
Well, Vargas got so many good one-liners to, like, end a scene. Like, he had at least two or three, right?
Yeah, he was like, see ya, amigo.
Well, no, the one where he's like, save your tears for, like, the or whatever, the ones who went to their deaths innocent or something. Like, no, that was it was save your tears for the innocent ones. And I was like, oh, what? Like,
So good. So good.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, I think it's time to get off the fence. Yes. A few questions regarding this.
Okay, I'm ready.
So my first question is this film still relevant today? The Touch of Evil.
I think for its art form it is, but broadly,
no.
As sort of a like historical benchmark in like the Hays Code collapsing and in Orson Welles' career and in like I don't know, like I would say it depends. It doesn't universally, you can't assume anyone should watch it. But a lot of people that are interested in any of these things would get something out of watching it.
Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't that big of a fan. I don't really think it holds up that well. I think if you're looking for these kind of long shots, I understand, and I do love like callbacks and seeing the original of things. Mm-hmm. However, this is just like one of those things where it just feels like it just doesn't stand out to me as a profound film for me.
Yeah,
personally.
It stands out as a 1950s film.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know? Yes, yeah.
You weren't changed.
No.
Your life wasn't changed.
No.
I mean, it's mostly not relevant, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think there's some elements that's like, oh, that's interesting for today, but I think most of it's pretty dated.
No one wants to see like a bad cop be really fucking bad. You know what I mean?
Comically bad.
Yes.
Racist.
I mean, I kind of liked that just because it was like, he just did a fucking good job at being gross. I mean, that's all I got to say.
Good villain.
Speak English. Oh, I don't speak Mexican.
Also, also on the topic of a good villain, as I wanted to say this earlier, is that I felt like a good villain is someone who's, whether they're talking or not talking, just when they're on screen, you just feel it, you know? And I just, it was just like fun. And I think it was fun to watch him for that. But I've also seen a good number of villains, you know, in modern era. So
another thing to make him an even better villain is that he should have had some sort of regret because he clearly did a lot of bad things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was only so much depth that he had.
Right. It's very two dimensional.
Maybe his lover was his regret, you know, not taking that seriously or something.
I mean, they allude to it, but they don't actually go into it.
You can tell it doesn't really faze him, you know?
Yeah. And that's why I feel like this is like what Pacific Rim is for robot films. This is like for film noir, where it's like almost good at being a trashy movie, you know, it aspired to be fun. And it's incidentally like got some interesting shots.
Yep.
It's not really fun once you get out of like when you get past the MTV era of editing. It's like this is not moving at the right pace. But it's fun if you're like, oh, I'm gonna go through all the film noir movies, and you've like watched four Humphrey Bogart films where every shot's a middle shot, and it's just two people going, how'd you get that? Well, I got this, and this one's like, oh my god, there's like a Cadillac convertible, and there's a bomb going off, and there's like a gang sneaking into like a highway side motel, and like weird things that don't really happen in any other movie.
It's so visually stunning. I wish I could just have it on in the background on mute.
Yeah, it would go very well with like tunes and a mute. Yeah.
Yes, I agree with that. I hate to say it, but I completely agree with that. I could put like, it could totally just be jazz. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just like more of a vibe. You have like a all of your hue lights are sent to like a value across.
Back to the hue lights.
Yeah, like it like starts as zero over the TV and then goes all the way to 100 at the end of your place. That would be kind of cool, man.
Oh, yeah. That would be, because we did that with Fallen Angels, right?
Yeah.
That was
it was Playboi Carti that was playing. It was pretty fun.
It was nice.
I think I know the answer to this question, but Mike, do you think this is better than Citizen Kane?
Okay, actually, I mean, if you're, you know, Citizen Kane has become a really big cliche in a lot of ways because that's kind of the cost of like winning your art form. Like if you become the sea change where like everything starts imitating you because you are the first example becomes kind of forgettable. So if we're asking the same question of like, is this relevant today? Like, if I had to pick between Citizen Kane and this movie for you learn all about cinema from one movie, it would be a tough race. You know, there's a lot more in this movie that's not in Citizen Kane. It's built on top of that, you know.
But I think the storytelling of Citizen Kane is much better. You have this descent. We have this man who falls from grace, kind of like Icarus flying too close to the sun type of thing.
But that's all he does. I mean, Quinlan falls from grace and then becomes an active agent of a villain in like someone else's life. And that's examined, you know?
I guess.
I'm just saying.
You're building up this movie more than it should be.
No. I don't want to build up Citizen Kane too much because Citizen Kane only survives through a historical lens, in my opinion. It does not. There are movies that are like not even great, just really good movies that you could learn as much cinema from. You could watch Phantom of the Paradise, like the like tacky musical film, and learn all about filmmaking that you learn from Citizen Kane. I'll stand by that statement. Like every shot, every like cross cut or fade in or ironic plot point used wasn't used really well in Phantom of the Paradise. It was dumb, goofy fun, but you get everything from Charlie Chaplin to that movie, you know, and there's a lot of movies that will do that. That's all I'm saying.
Citizen Kane.
I haven't seen either of these movies, but I know how ridiculous Phantom of the Paradise is. So I at least understand the gravity of this take, but I think I'm going to like also cut in and say to interject between y'all's conversation. I wish we saw Citizen Kane instead today.
We should have.
Because I just kind of feel like, because I feel like as an intro to Orson Welles, I was just like, I would have rather just seen the best thing and not his like follow up in like, you know, him being distracted.
You want to see his first thing.
Because I don't want to see him being like, I don't want his work being distracted because. Distracted by studio pressure. Yeah.
Mm. The mechanism that he found himself
in. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Because, like, you know, maybe even creating this noir film and him being like this gross person was kind of his outlet. Being like, fuck this. You know
his fuck you to the cinema like industry. Like, all right, you think I'm like an exiled weird piece of crap that no one wants around? Like, I'll make a movie where I'm a weird piece of crap. But at the end,
every exiled person does that, though.
Yeah, I mean, but that's okay. When you talk about it that broadly, that's just the way we all construct our identity in our given environment. Like we're forced to redefine the things that we cannot avoid or shed, you know, like, so sure. But also he very specifically, like, you know, he went off to Europe and he like hit nothing that he did. I think he said this in one of his interviews of like, oh, if you could do it all over again or live in it, would you? And he's like, oh yeah, easily. And they're like, well, but now have you like picked friends over like good actors or good cinematographers just because you want to be comfortable? And he's like, oh, that's all I do now. You know? So I think he was beyond his time, but he knew he was, but it wasn't less than him at the peak of his time. It's just the world was so much smaller than when he started, you know, he did it before America was in World War II, you know, and then now there's this layer of how conflict in the community is different. It was after World War II, you know?
Of course. Right. I guess this is a better question to ask. Is this a good representation of film noir?
No, unless it's about as good of a representation as Blade Runner is, you know, like it's strikingly fitting the definition, but not in a way that makes it resemble the genre.
Right.
You know?
Okay. Yeah. It's a genre bend, if you will.
Yeah.
I feel like it's like post noir, if that's even a thing.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
there's noir and then this is like, well, this is like kind of noir. So it's like kind of branching out.
Yeah. I would say that. Have you guys ever heard of the like moral versus psychological versus sociological storytelling?
Nope.
Okay, so like
Game of Thrones.
Right, Game of Thrones or Les Mis. Sociological storytelling is the broadest one where you want to show the way a society or a community changes. City of God's another one. So you tell the change of that community through many, many stories, right? And psychological storytelling is a step back from that, where you have independent individuals. Golden Age of Hollywood is hyper-psychological storytelling, not really at all. A little bit moral storytelling, but it pivots on the choices individuals make, and the end result is like very individualistic in its outcome for everyone.
It's like the conflict within yourself type of thing.
Yeah, and so the point I'm getting at here is that film noir came out as the during the height of psychological storytelling. The old moral storytelling of I tell a story because it tells you how to do things the right way, which is like the oldest form of storytelling. It had gone beyond that. It was willing to like simultaneously operate amorally or immorally, but it wasn't yet sociological. And you're kind of getting a little bit of that in this movie. You know, you're getting, they're showing you the conditions of Americans and Mexicans and how they interact. And that's a significant force in the story. And if you're not aware of that force, a lot of the story would probably make no sense. Like if you're from India or you're from, I don't know, a country that may not have a lot of knowledge of it. Like, I guess everyone knows about America nowadays. But if you had somebody who didn't know the dynamic at the U.S.-Mexican border, they didn't know the tropes, they didn't know the distrust, they didn't know the archetypical roles and like the common sense, you would the parts of this movie be like, okay, well, what is that? You know,
it's very cultural.
Yeah. And so I think it's at the end of psychological storytelling, on the eve of sociological storytelling, that you sort of see this movie.
Yes. My final question.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Would you recommend this movie to a friend?
I would recommend it to most of my friends.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I can't believe you would. No, I would not, dude. No.
Are you like a sadist?
No, but that's the thing. I watch a lot of.
Yeah. You watch, you're a film boy.
I mean, I watch a lot of like fast cinema is such a recent thing.
I'm not saying it needs to be fast. I'm saying there's better examples of film noir. There's better examples of
Orson, if you thought Welles this was movie. Slow, you're going to think Maltese Falcon is like a crawl. Or like,
have you seen Maltese Falcon?
I have not. Neither have I.
But like, you know, then if it's a crawl, it's a crawl. But this movie was a crawl.
The context is important as well. The story being told is important as well. Because my problem was like, is a stop and go. It's like, all right, we're speeding up. Okay, time to stop. And it's like, if it's consistently a certain pace, that's fine. Mm-hmm. It could be slow. I watch boring ass movies. I watch A24 movies.
So, see, because that's what I think was this was a sort of movie that is trying to be more kinetic than its predecessors. And
it's trying.
But if you watched a movie today, right, like a movie like Hot Fuzz or Shaun of the Dead, where there's these brutally fast cuts in the middle of a much more typically paced movie, breakfast. Right. But the you're used to the default. So the effort to surpass it and then go back to it isn't really much of a like an editing offense. But when the movie's already slower than you're used to and there's brief moments where it's a little faster or the same speed that you're used to, you're like, God, you were transcending the crap and now you're back in it. Oh, like that's the feeling you get when the movie goes back to being too slow. Like you can't keep forgiving its slowness because you see that it's capable of being faster, you know? So I think it is a relative thing.
It is.
It's okay. 1 out of 3. That's fine.
1 out of 3.
1 out of 3. Yeah. A very like, sorry.
No, you're good. I think I'm throwing a little shade and that's okay. I think I'm literally
deservedly so.
I feel so bad. Oh,
I feel embarrassed for even recommending this.
Whoa.
I should have just said Citizen Kane.
Whoa.
Mike was like, let's watch an Orson Welles movie. I'm like, well, I don't want to be the normie.
Yo,
let me pick something else. But
can I be completely honest too? Yeah. When I this whole like Touch of Evil thing went by so fast because before, and I think let me kind of set the tone for everybody here. We talked about watching 65, which is like the recent Adam Driver movie where it's literally landing on a planet with dinosaurs and it's apparently
65 million years ago. Yeah, 65 humans million discovered Earth and I was like, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
and then we did like a hyperspace jump to Touch of Evil, and I was open for it because
I recommended Butt Boy, and you guys didn't want to.
Oh yeah, I could. Yeah, that was like crickets in the chat. I'm so sorry.
I see the mode you're in, but everybody's mode for goofy film gets hyper. Like mine is that, you know, the Phantom of the Paradise thing I mentioned. Like, who else wants to watch that movie? Like,
I mean, I think I would watch it, but then I would have to then tell you after the movie if I could like sit through a podcast and talk. You know what I mean? It's a little honesty.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, but my point is, like, it's not a particularly great film for my gaze. It was a novelty.
Okay.
And my goofy little prison of context, it was a joyous party favor, you know?
Yes.
And
a joyous party favor. You know, I think if I get this correct, by the way,
yeah,
I think I figured out the theme, boys.
What's the theme?
Mulholland Drive was Armand's pick. My pick
was more of Mike's pick.
What? Well, is this accurate?
Yeah. Because Mike recommended it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You did?
And I pulled my friend into it, Anthony, because it's his favorite movie of all time.
Yeah.
So then we can say it's Anthony's pick. No, but... So that was Anthony's pick. So, you know, Shin Ultraman was mine. Yeah. Mike's was Touch of Evil. And this means that Armand gets to pick the next one. We figured it
watching
out.
Watching Butt Boy. We're not going to watch Butt Boy.
Okay.
I'll pick something good.
Should we actually do Citizen Kane? Because I feel like if someone's listening to this podcast,
we need to redeem Orson Welles.
Yeah, we also need to officially be like, I'm surprised that, I don't know. I really want to show you guys a Tarkovsky movie, but if this is slow, Tarkovsky is syrup, you know.
Children's End or Childhood's End?
No.
Not the Arthur C. Clarke book.
No, it's Tarkovsky did like Solaris and Stalker.
Well, he did. Well, I know he did those.
I feel like
he did Childhood's End, Children's End. It's a World War II movie.
I got my phone. We're going to look this up.
Anyways, guys, it's been real. Anyways, we'll pick something good.
Yeah.
I'll pick something good.
Yeah. Yo, yes.
Until next time. What?
It is on you.
It's on me. Guys, this has been a lot of fun. It was a good time.
Yes. Yeah. Always a great time talking with y'all.
I wanted to say the whole time of us finding this movie and then watching it and talking about it, definitely better than the movie. I'll concede that much.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
I think out of any of the lowest blows that I was worried to, you know, to give, yours was like, damn, man.
No, I mean, I had this movie saved. I've watched it. This is, I think, the third or fourth time I've watched it.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Really?
Nice. Yeah. So like,
I would never watch this again.
Wow.
Here it comes.
The real opinion.
I mean,
here we go.
I second that. So
Diego's just like, the film gave me cancer.
I mean, I would screenshot certain frames like, oh, this is fucking awesome. But yes. Like,
I agree with that. I agree. A gif of some, you know, like a little chopped up little. There you go.
I would print it out.
We gotta do like maybe Citizen Kane is the one, but at some point we gotta do like a 30s, like even if it's good, it's filmed like all middle shots that are like 10 seconds long, you know?
It's okay. Compared to the last movie we did, yeah, this is a complete opposite. Like,
1080 turn.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Yeah. Are you ready to close this out?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much.
No, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. See ya.
See ya.
See ya.
That's it for this time on The Syndicate. We hope you enjoyed yourself. Keep the conversation going by adding us on Instagram and Letterboxd at Syndicate. Or join the Discord server where you can catch Armand along other podcasters and listeners at syndicate.com/discord. And until next time, stop that scroll and spend more time watching. Goodbye.